This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, we look at efforts to limit the environmental consequences of war. One international treaty was prompted by U.S. efforts to cause flooding in North Vietnam. Connecticut family farmers are becoming an endangered species. They're devising ways to avoid extinction. Listeners commented everything from cattle grazing to why the Environment Show is a threat to democracy. And on the Earth calendar, we go ice fishing in northern Minnesota. Just thinking about it makes you shiver. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. War can have serious environmental consequences. In this first of a series, we look at efforts to limit environmental war damage through international treaties. Later, we'll talk to U.S. military leaders about how environmental considerations affect the conduct of U.S. military operations. Environmental damage has been part of warfare from the beginning. The Romans salted the ground around Carthage to prevent the city from recovering. In World War II, the Germans bombed the dikes in Holland to flood the countryside as they retreated. In Southeast Asia, the U.S. induced floods in North Vietnam and defoliated jungle areas with Agent Orange. During the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein torched the Kuwaiti oil fields, polluting the skies, and was responsible for massive oil spills in the Gulf. During this century, treaties have been promulgated to limit environmental consequences of war. Hayes Parks, Special Assistant for Law of War Matters for the Judge Advocate General of the United States Army, explains.
There are treaty obligations that you avoid unnecessary destruction. And that's not anything new. That's been around since the turn of the century. At the same time, there's also the recognition that obviously war is going to cause damage to the environment. So it's not that treaty obligations will prevent damage to the environment, but it's supposed to prevent or at least prohibit any type of destruction that's unnecessary. In some cases, damage to the environment will be necessary.
One of the first was adopted at the turn of the century.
There's a 1907 Hague Convention regulating the conduct of war on land that authorizes only destruction that is necessary to attainment of a military objective. It actually dates back to 1899, but the 1907 treaty replaced the 1899 obligation. There is an obligation in the 1977 Additional Protocol 1, to which the United States is not a party, that prohibits attacks on the environment as such. Now, that does not mean that damage to the environment as a result of legitimate combat operations is prohibited. There is also a treaty known as the Environmental Modification Treaty of 1977, and it is misunderstood by many people. In fact, what it prohibits is the use of the environment as a method of warfare.
And wasn't there a time during the Vietnamese conflict when we did some cloud seeding and other things in North Vietnam to bring about torrential rains?
Yes, there was. And in fact, I think that's probably one of the reasons that brought about the NMOD convention. In fact, there was a certain irony to that. First, it did not necessarily impede the North Vietnamese transportation of supplies to the south, but also, as you may recall, it also caused severe rain in North Vietnam that caused our prisoners of war to be moved out of the San Tay prisoner of war camp because of the potential flooding. And this happened just 6 weeks before. In fact, our rescue forces went in there to try to rescue them. So it turned against us to some degree.
The 1977 documents focus on widespread, long-lasting, or severe damage. But despite the protocol, some ambiguity remains. I asked whether the defoliation campaigns in Vietnam, which were intended to remove jungle canopy from Viet Cong supply trails and roadside ambush positions, but also left the residue of Agent Orange behind, would be prohibited.
I don't know that I can give you a clear answer. I think the school solution is still out as to whether or not the damage that was done long-term actually existed. Certainly, the area has grown up again. you're again perhaps the best person to ask about this is Admiral Zumwalt, since he made the decisions, and of course, as you know, his son was serving there at the time.
Yes.
That's the type of thing a military commander has to weigh. Was that effective? I do think it saved American lives. Did it damage the environment? Yes, it did. Was the damage long-term and severe? That's going to be more of a question of fact and a question of science to answer. Was it, under the existing law, illegal? No. Was it? Is it? Would it be illegal under the law today? I'm not sure. I don't think that that was the intent of the drafters of the 1977 Additional Protocol 1. What they were looking at more was something along the lines of what Saddam Hussein did in Desert Storm, the very intentional destruction of the oil wells, they're burning and what have you.
Legal scholars say that a number of things are happening now which may provide a broader framework to deal with the environmental consequences of war. Jay Austin, senior staff attorney at the Environmental Law Institute, says one example is the commission that was set up to force Iraq to pay civil damages for environmental losses.
The commission was created by UN Security Resolution 687, which is one of the resolutions ending the war, and that resolution presumed Iraq's liability for all damages resulting from its invasion and occupation of Kuwait. And environmental damages were identified in the resolution as a subset of the damages for which claims could be filed. Understandably, most of the claims have been filed by Kuwait, but also adjacent nations such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, some of the other Gulf nations. There have been reports of environmental damage as far away as the Himalayas in India from some of the air impacts from the burning oil wells.
Austin says discussions about establishing a new international criminal court that took place in Rome last summer also had an environmental dimension.
Well, the treaty creating the court, again, specifically carves out environmental damage, or in the words of the treaty, excessive environmental damage, as one type of war crimes in a long list of war crimes. And it's actually consistent with a body of international law that first started to be developed in the late 1960s and early 1970s as a response to the Vietnam War.
He says that under these provisions, a military commander who egregiously flouted environmental norms could be prosecuted as a war criminal. Finally, former Soviet Chief of State Gorbachev is traveling around the world advocating the establishment of an international fund to compensate victims of war-induced environmental destruction. He calls it Green Cross, and it would operate something like a no-fault insurance policy. Nobody believes that a combination of civil, criminal, and insurance remedies will stop environmental destruction by rogue states. But domestic and international environmental law is having a profound effect on the way the U.S. conducts its own military operations. In the next part of our series, we'll hear from our armed services and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Connecticut farmers are struggling to survive in one of the most densely populated states in the nation. Although much of the state's agricultural output depends on commercial farms that grow mushrooms and harvest oysters, there's also a fair number of old-fashioned farmers raising dairy cows, selling livestock, eggs, maple syrup, and fruit. But just like farmers in other states, they're threatened by development and low profits. Now, a small consortium of progressive Connecticut farmers have gotten together to guarantee a future for their industry. From Connecticut Public Radio, John Dankosky reports.
The people you find on farms are people that just have a love for farming and are dedicated people to the industry.
Arnold Niemann is the dairy unit manager at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. He says many students in animal sciences would like to farm, but know they wouldn't make enough money to pay off their school loans.
One of the juniors said that he'd very much like to go farming, but couldn't afford to do this, so he was going to go into research, and hopefully by the time he was 35, he would have accumulated enough money so he could possibly go. Farms are becoming scarcer and scarcer and costing more to get into the business.
And once you get into the business, it can be even harder to make a profit. The cost of machinery is high, profits can fluctuate wildly, and the land to grow crops is being sold to developers each year. Several of Connecticut's small to mid-sized farmers have found the only way to get ahead is to work together. Their group is called Very Alive, and its mission is to inform the public about Connecticut agriculture and to promote investment in the industry. As a way to take their case directly to state legislators, the group gave a feast and farm tour, an opportunity to let lawmakers and local officials see a farm in action, talk about issues, and eat Connecticut-grown food.
We have to get funding, though, because we're losing land so rapidly, and you don't know until you see a sign goes up. So a sign goes up on a piece of land.
And it's too late.
It's too late. It's gone. I mean, you're 6 months to a year behind the eight ball, you know?
Mm-hmm. Ned Ellis runs Maple Leaf Farm in Hebron. He hosted the get-together. He got a chance to talk to State Representative Pam Sawyer about topics ranging from open space to taxes.
We have a $100,000 exemption on equipment, I think, and
is $100,000 enough?
If you buy a tractor, for instance,
it eats it up pretty fast.
That's a 10-year-old tractor. It was back in 1990, it was $65,000, and probably now it's $95,000. So that's one piece of equipment. A chopper's $30,000, but we haven't bought a new chopper for quite a while.
So
we got three old ones.
If you had a year that you had to buy two pieces of equipment, it might cause you a problem.
Yeah, then you're going to have to pay something, right.
Okay, so maybe at this stage we should be talking about moving the $100,000 up because of the cost of equipment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Connecticut's government has already helped support area farmers with a massive plan that will help each town set aside open space for future generations. In the past 13 years alone, Connecticut has lost almost 21% of its farmland. Another step has been the Northeast Dairy Compact, an agreement between states that ensures a higher base price for a gallon of milk produced in New England. Dorothy Jacquier says farms like hers in East Canaan are staying alive because of the agreement. Since few are getting rich from selling their milk, they depend on neighbors for equipment and labor.
The machinery to do all phases of farming is very expensive, so we've been sharing. We help neighbors, and they do things for us, so which makes it a lot friendlier group.
Representative Pam Sawyer says that Vary Alive's message of cooperation has hit home. She sees the survival of the state's remaining farmers as a high priority during the next legislative session.
We are looking at food production here. And when you look at the cost of having to move food and food product, that you really have to look at what you still have locally to be able to, I think, preserve a local economy.
Overall, the farmers here see a revival in interest in their profession, which may help keep it alive into the future. Since farming now involves as much knowledge of commodities markets, soil chemistry, and public relations as it does proper milking techniques, local colleges and universities are grooming the farmers of the future.
At the university, we just had 106 freshmen come into animal science, which is a very large class. It's one of the largest since the late 60s, early 70s.
Arnold Niemann of the University of Connecticut says all of the issues that Vary Alive addresses, taxes, compacts, education, and land preservation, are important to the future of farming in the state. But most important is the realization that without farmers, there won't be enough food to sustain Connecticut in the future. For The Environment Show, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
We welcome new additions to the list of more than 200 stations carrying The Environment Show. They're Massachusetts broadcasters WFPB AM, WBPR FM, and WFPB FM, new sister stations of WUMB near Boston, which has broadcast the show for some time. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, www.hemmings.com. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Several weeks ago, we broadcast an Environment Show quiz. We played this sound. We asked you to identify it, and in 25 words or less, comment on its environmental significance. Listener Christopher Smith correctly reported that it was a subway train and said, quote, "To those who are riding the subway, thanks for leaving your car at home, or better yet, for not even owning one," end quote. Chris Smith wins the prize, a towel made of pure organic cotton, complete with the Environment Show logo. Other comment that might have been made is the relevance of light rail to the future of cities. Imagine a big city without traffic jams and smog. Light rail and streets off limits to the private automobile could take us there. But I must say, commuters on the New York City subway system in the summer experience times when that Environment Show towel would be welcome. While the cars are air-conditioned, there is nothing more oppressive than a subway platform on a muggy summer day when outside temperature is over 95 and it's hotter below ground. With mental discipline, you might convince yourself that you're in a steam bath at the spa. But in reality, you feel like the stuffing in a steamed Chinese dim sum pudding. It's time now to hear what some of you are saying. Here's the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott.
Roland, a resident of eastern Massachusetts, heard our discussion on the issue of cattle grazing on federal lands. He says our guests only spoke at each other, which did not provide the listener with enough information.
The fact that grazing animals can improve some lands was not admitted to by the environmentalists, and the damage that cattle have done was not even admitted to by the rancher. It seemed as if they were just merely being spokesmen for their cause, when what we really need to hear from are people working to come up with solutions to these problems, ways that cattle can remain on the land, people can work, and yet the land won't be damaged.
Bill Blatt sent an email saying he heard a recent discussion on urban sprawl. He says, quote, "Good as far as it went, but if you're really going to deal with sprawl and resource use, you've got to talk about our tax structure, particularly the real property tax," end quote. Fred Carville also contacted us by electronic mail to say that we should use segments of the show to educate young people. Fred says, quote, "More often than not, we find out about potential problems when environmental problems become critical. A more educated public with in-depth knowledge of the environment through continuous education will react responsibly through their lives when their actions or decisions impact the environment," end quote. Listener Robert Bijak heard a conversation with members of the Environment Show Advisory Board. The topic was attitudes that need to be changed to bring about a sustainable planet. Robert disagreed with most everything he heard and says the conversation was filled with what he calls veiled socialist rhetoric.
Cleverly worded, but to a sentient person, you can see what the thrust of the program is. This is just to turn people's thinking around and to think away from democracy, to think towards nebulous globalism and communal living. This is not what America is or will be, and here's one person who will fight you folks right down the line.
Joan from Syracuse, New York, also heard the discussion about attitudes that need to be changed to bring about a sustainable planet. She says more emphasis needs to be placed on education and adds that the issue of trash, specifically packaging, is one that needs to be addressed.
Instead of spending money on how to market this new product, they could be taking that money and putting it into secondary recycling markets and then supporting it by their products, by packaging their products in such a way as to cut down, reduce, and then use the secondary recycling markets.
Finally, we recently discussed environmental issues the Clinton administration should address in the next 2 years. The guests discussed the importance of addressing climate change and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Peter Bergen contacted us by email to say reducing reliance on fossil fuels isn't so simple and says our guests offered no solutions. Peter believes the United States should revive the nation's nuclear power industry. He says, quote, there's an awful lot of enriched special nuclear material left over from the Cold War that is still lying around the USA and former Soviet Union. We should literally beat those old swords into plowshares and solve two problems at once, air pollution and nuclear proliferation, end quote. We always want to hear your thoughts, suggestions, and story ideas. Call our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm listed under lonely, lost and feeling small. Dial directly to my heart and bill me for the call.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, folks are ice fishing in Lake Winnebogoshish, known as Lake Winnie, in Minnesota. Ice fishing involves sitting next to a hole in the ice, waiting for a fish to grab the baited hook lowered into the water. The 58,000-acre lake is located in the heart of the Chippewa National Forest. Bob Klein is owner of the Nodak Lodge, one of the 15 resorts along the lake, and he says now is the time that walleye are biting.
Most of them would be in the 13 to 16, 17-inch bracket, which would be, you know, a 16-incher would be about a pound and a half, which is your prime eating size anyway. We do get them up to 6, 7, 8 pounds. But you do have a battle trying to get one of them through the hole also. We have had some pretty nice ones caught this year, but most of the bigger ones are thrown back.
Klein adds plenty of perch, northern pike, and muskellunge are also found in Lake Winnie. He says the conditions for ice fishing are excellent right now. The ice is 20 inches thick, making it safe enough to drive all-terrain vehicles, cars, and trucks with plows on the ice. More than 100 miles of plowed roads are created on the lake, which makes it easy for people to find just the right fishing spot. When they find the spot, many folks use large gas-powered augers that drill an 8 to 10-inch hole in the ice. Again, Bob Klein.
Some people have little portable houses, canvas collapsible houses that they set up. You basically go out on the lake and you, you want to be on some kind of structure where the drop-offs are and whatnot. And you drill a hole through the ice and you have your jig rods, or lots of guys fishing outside will even use their regular fishing rods. And you drop her down to the bottom with a little... Swedish pimples or any little daredevils, and a minnow, and you jig off the bottom.
In addition, fishermen and women often bring small heaters into the portable houses to keep them warm on those cold, wintry days in northern Minnesota. Ice fishing itself has not changed much over the years, but Bob Klein says he has seen changes in the number of people enjoying the sport over the 45 years his family has owned the lodge.
The younger people are not really taking up the sport as much as they used to. They're going more to angling, where you can, you're not just sitting there looking down a hole. You're bouncing around from hole to hole in different places, fishing and drilling a hole and angling. So there has been a definite change in the way that they fish. Used to be very, very few people that went out and angled, but that's before we had the power augers and everything else. You had to go out and chisel a hole with a hand chisel, and you start chiseling through 2-3 foot of ice. That's a lot of work.
Bob adds that electronic depth finders are enabling fishers to determine the depth of the water compared to doing it manually. The Nodak Lodge can bed about 100 people and is open all year round. Bob says folks come from faraway states just to try ice fishing on Lake Winnie. So when your pipes freeze up at home and the car won't start and the cold is making you grumpy, just head to northern Minnesota. Home will seem like a tropical paradise. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Bye.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, more than half of the first group of endangered Mexican wolves that were reintroduced in Arizona were shot. Now the Fish and Wildlife Service is preparing to release another group. Can they survive human predation? We talk green about the Endangered Species Act. Does it need to be strengthened or weakened? It depends on who you talk to. Taking a break from winter, author William Tapley helps us recall fishing in the summer, when swallows snag mosquitoes, herons spear sunfish, and the big bass is not to be found. Stay with us. Federal officials are looking for those responsible for shooting five endangered Mexican gray wolves, which had been released in the Blue Range area of Arizona in 1998. Now, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is preparing to release nine more. Sean Dudley has the story.
Before the 1870s, wolves roamed free in the territories of Arizona and New Mexico. Within 100 years, they were nearly extinct. The last confirmed wild Mexican gray wolf in the United States was killed near Alpine, Texas, in 1970. Roger Schlickhuysen is the president and CEO of Defenders of Wildlife, based in Washington, D.C. He says the Mexican wolves alive today are descended from five wolves trapped during the 1970s.
The Mexican wolf was listed as endangered and protected under the Endangered Species Act in 1976. In 1977, 78, 79, 80, in that time period, the Fish and Wildlife Service employed professional trapper to go try to find the last remaining Mexican wolves. And in all that period, he only found five. They were all in Mexico, and of the five, only one was a female. So they took the five and put them into a captive breeding facility, outside of Tucson. And from that, they've rebuilt a population of approximately 200 Mexican wolves.
Schlickhuysen says the fate of the Mexican wolves fell upon one female of the species.
The Mexican wolf came about as close to extinction as a species can get, obviously when it's down to one female. Fortunately, the four males that they captured were from different parts of the country, and therefore offered enough genetic variation that they were able to rebuild a stable population, even though they only had one female.
Few people have seen a Mexican wolf, which is smaller than its northern relative. Wendy Brown, project coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Wolf Restoration Project in Albuquerque, New Mexico, describes the animal.
Well, the Mexican wolf is a gray wolf. It's a subspecies of the gray wolf. So it's essentially, it's the same species as what people think of as the timber wolf or the Arctic wolf, but it is the southwestern representative of that species, and it's a distinct subspecies. As a matter of fact, it's most genetically distinct of all the gray wolf subspecies, and probably the rarest in the world. It's about the size of a good-sized German Shepherd. Females weigh between 60 and 80 pounds. They tend to be fairly similar in coloration. In the north, you might see wolves that were solid black or solid white and various shades of gray. Mexican gray wolves tend to be this very beautiful, rich mixture of browns and blacks and kind of a rufous color with some fairly distinctive facial markings.
In 1997, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was ordered to reintroduce Mexican wolves into the wild. In early 1998, 11 wolves were released into the Apache Sitgreaves Forest in Arizona. Wendy Brown says the wolves didn't fare as well as expected.
Five of our wolves have been shot, and a sixth disappeared, which is probably dead, may well have been shot as well.
The Fish and Wildlife Service was able to recapture two remaining male wolves, which were paired with mates and eventually re-released. Polls showed public outrage over the killing of the endangered wolves, but Jeff Mingus, executive vice president of the Arizona Cattle Growers Association, says that in ranching communities near the release areas, local sentiment runs against the wolf project.
These wolves have been raised for generations in captivity and fed by people, and they associate people with food. And so that's where they're hanging out, up and down the roads and wherever there's people. And so to this point, they've had to keep supplemental feeding them. They haven't been able to kill enough animals to sustain themselves. And to this point, it looks like the project is a failure to us.
The Cattle Growers Association maintains there isn't enough wild prey to support a projected wolf population of 100 individuals. They say wolves will eventually be forced to prey upon cattle, and although Defenders of Wildlife has set up a fund to pay ranchers who can prove their livestock has been killed by wolves, Jeff Mingus says it's not that simple.
The problem with that is, if you got a pack of wolves running through and say it's calving season and there's a little baby calf there and the wolves come through and kill the calf, they'll eat hide, hair, bones, everything. And there won't even be any sign of it, nothing but a cow standing there with you know, an udder full of milk and bawling for a calf. And it's pretty difficult to prove that a wolf actually killed something like that. So you're not going to be able to confirm very many of the kills.
Although some have grown suspicious of local ranchers who have voiced opposition to the project, Mingus says he doubts any rancher is responsible for killing the endangered wolves.
I don't think any rancher is going to take the risk to kill a wolf. I think it's like a $100,000 fine and a 5-year prison penalty. But even worse than that, if a rancher that ranches on public land, and you know, over 80% of the land in Arizona is public, if he's convicted of a felony, well, he'll lose his grazing privileges.
Roger Schlickhuysen says opposition to the project is fueled by superstition surrounding the wolf. He says that wolf populations in other parts of the country kill few livestock, and he claims there have been no documented cases of a wolf killing or seriously injuring a human.
Human beings weren't named to be God and decide which species live and die on this planet. In an increasingly urbanized existence, it's important to us to know that wild nature still exists someplace out there. And the wolf, probably more than any other single creature, unless it's the grizzly bear, helps define wildness in North America.
Defenders of Wildlife and the U.S. Fish and Game Service are offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of those responsible for killing Mexican gray wolves. At the time of this report, 9 more Mexican wolves were being moved into rural Arizona in preparation for their release into the wild. For the Environment Show, I'm Sean Dudley.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're discussing the Endangered Species Act, which has now been on the books for 25 years. And while it had a quiet beginning over the last few years, it has stirred up a lot of controversy. Environmentalists want it strengthened, and I think it's fair to say that development interests want it either weakened or modified substantially, and so support for the Endangered Species Act has been a litmus test for congresspeople and senators, which has been applied universally by environmental rating groups like the League of Conservation Voters and the Sierra Club. This year, reauthorization of the ESA is on the congressional agenda once again, although in the last couple of years, Congress has not gotten around to it. My guests represent both sides of the spectrum on this issue. Brock Evans is Executive Director of the Endangered Species Coalition, and that's a coalition of environmental groups who want to preserve and strengthen the Act. Formerly, Brock was Vice President of the National Audubon Society. And Jack Mingus, he is Communication Director of the Endangered Species Act Reform Coalition. That organization represents the interests of development interests in ranchers and mining companies and others who argue that the Act infringes on individual rights and needs to be rewritten. So, Brock, let's start with you, and again for our listeners who may not be familiar with this, how does the Endangered Species Act work, very briefly?
Well, basically, it works, let me just say first that when Congress passed this in 1973, Peter, it was unique and visionary in its time. It's the first time any legislative body in the world ever made a statement which said that any living species within our territorial boundaries, if we can prevent it going extinct, we will do so. It's a noble expression, and it's existed as a beacon to other countries in the world, too. The way it works, briefly, and Jack may want to add to this also, is that The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, a federal agency, and the Department of Interior is given overall authority to oversee the management of the act, except for marine species, and that's the National Marine and Fisheries Service, which has authority there. They survey the national landscape of plants and animals and invertebrate species, and they receive recommendations and petitions to list species as endangered. That's a crucial part of the process where various scientific bodies within the agencies and elsewhere look at this. If they determine that a species deserves a listing called threatened or an endangered, and those are technical terms, and it finally gets survives it and gets on the listing process, then the agencies are obliged on federal lands to take certain actions no longer to jeopardize those species and bring them harm. The agencies are supposed to develop plans to recover the species on federal lands, at least. But it also applies to any person, meaning corporations or private owners in private lands as well. It means they cannot take actions which will also harm the species. And harm is determined to mean not to shoot them or kill them, but also harm their habitat. Because the visionary part of the Congressional Act in 73 is they realize that habitat, the species cannot survive without a place to eat and sleep and food and have food and reproduce and everything else. And so that's the crucial part, and I can see why many development interests don't like it.
Okay, well,
other activities.
That kind of lays it out. Jack, what's wrong with it?
In and of itself, nothing is really wrong with the Endangered Species Act. The ideas behind the Endangered Species Act are solid, and they're ones that we wholeheartedly support. What it comes down to simply is from our group's point of view is that it can simply be done better. The way the act is currently set up is that there is no incentive for these private landowners and private individuals to want to work to protect species that are on their property. The discovery of an endangered species on your land brings along a whole series of restrictions upon how you can use your land. Which, in one hand, from an environmental point of view, makes sense. You don't want to have anything else happen to the property or happen to the habitat of an endangered species, and we understand that. But from another point of view, that is land that someone or some entity has purchased and had intentions to use. And our organization all along has said, that's fine. If you want to protect the endangered species that are on that property, we wholeheartedly support that. But you cannot make the individual landowners carry on their back the burden for a national goal of protecting endangered species.
Do you see this somewhat differently, Brock?
Well, yes and no. I think that Jack's people make a point which we actually agree with, and we've introduced legislation which we hope accommodates that somewhat. The Endangered Species Act needs to be made more responsive, especially to landowners who may have financial hardships because of all that. But what we don't want to do is promote more exterminations in so doing, and that's one of the issues today I know we'll get into a little bit later. So we do favor more financial incentives for people, but at the same time, there's a lot of people in our groups, and by the way, there's many religious groups who are members of our organization and scientific groups as well as environmental. We feel that just as you're not allowed to kill, say, game animals out of season, you shouldn't be allowed. You shouldn't be paid to exterminate a species. To not exterminate a species. That's
Jack,
the problem our
Jack
people
is,
have.
Jack, is your argument financial? That if any protection is out there, people are going to get paid for it, and as long as they are, then protection should go on.
I think that what we need to keep in mind here is that at any time, any sort of restrictions are placed on private property for any sort of use of it. People who own that property need to be involved in the process of setting up what those restrictions are.
Well, let me ask you something about that. Suppose somebody owns a city lot. It's subject to zoning. The owner normally isn't involved when that zoning law is passed, or it may have been years ago. Should he get paid if he can only put up a 20-story building instead of a 40-story building?
It's an interesting argument, but it's one that doesn't wholly apply here. When the person bought that land, in your example there, for the use of developing it, they knew that some sort of restrictions were going to be placed upon it, upon the way they could use it. What happens with the Endangered Species Act is that when often you buy this property, or whether you're going to be using it for farming or building or mining or ranching or whatever the purpose is, At the time you purchase this property or it comes into your possession, there are no restrictions placed upon it in terms of endangered species or wildlife issues. Normally, these sorts of things come up later.
But there clearly are with respect to wildlife. Just the fact that you own it doesn't mean you can hunt out a season. That's been there forever.
But the restriction placed on having having wildlife on it, I mean, if you're planning on farming this land here, you probably weren't going to be using that for going out and hunting elk or whatever it is that you're looking to put there. You're going to be using it for, I mean, when you bought that land, you knew that you couldn't go out and hunt elk on your farmland here, and you knew that going in. What happens with farmland, with the Endangered Species Act, pardon me, is that you bought farmland, you were planning on using it for farming, and you probably are using it for farming for 5, 10 years, a generation, and then, at that point, the Endangered Species restrictions fall upon you or your family, and suddenly you are unable to continue doing what you have been doing legally in the past for X number of years.
Okay, let's take another slice at this. Recently, Secretary Babbitt has come under tremendous criticism because he said, we'll work out a plan if there's an endangered species on a piece of ground, and we'll tell the landowner that once the plan is in effect, we won't go back and change it. And that, I know, has caused great consternation among some members of the environmental community. Brock, how do you feel about the efforts that Babbitt has been making to, in effect, give people some guarantees?
We think it's a good idea gone wrong and been misapplied. The good idea is in engaging landowners the way Jack suggested, which we agree with, and everybody participating in drafting a plan to protect the species, which we agree with. The problem is they make agreements which allow killing, you know, destruction of habitat of the species, and there are agreements for 25 to 50 years or longer sometimes, and there's no monitoring, there's no guarantee that this will happen. The trouble is that the scientific information is always evolving in this field. We find out new information, you can't change it, go back in and make the species better protected afterwards. And
Jack, how do your members feel about this approach that Babbitt has taken?
Well, obviously, I mean, these sorts of what we term regulatory certainty are things that our folks have been looking for. Because what has happened in the past is that there is nothing in the law that requires the federal government basically to live up to its part of the deal. Basically meaning you can make an agreement with the federal government, and this is all background right now, but I think up to the when you're not including Secretary Babbitt's no surprises policy, what can happen is the federal government comes in, makes a deal with you, and then you're living up to your end of the deal. And then 2, 3, 4 years down the road, the government comes in and goes, you know, no, we're going to change it now, and so you have to stop doing what you have been doing and do all these other additional things.
Well, but if the purpose of the deal is to save the species and the species isn't being saved because the plan didn't work, doesn't the government have an obligation to fix it to save the species?
Now the landowners have no incentive to keep the deal. You know, they make a deal and then they walk away. If I was a big timber company, I'd be lining up by the hundreds, and they are. They want to get a good deal and get a free pass for the next 50 years.
They're not,
and there's no check on it.
But the thing is here, they're not able to do it and then walk away from it. They have very specific restrictions that they agree to when signing this HCP, this Habitat Conservation Plan. And this is not something that is cooked up in the back rooms with all the cigar smoke floating in the air with evil people twirling their mustaches. I mean, this is something that is set up with scientists that represent both the landowners and the federal government.
It is cooked up in back rooms, and the public has very little chance to look at it. But the problem is, if it was enforced and was monitored by scientists and peer review, that would be one thing, but it's not right now. And probably we might be able to work out a better way of doing these things. We have a new bill that does that.
Let me ask you both something. The Act has been on the books for 25 years. There are hundreds of species either listed or getting ready to be listed, because I know there's a big backlog, and yet species are disappearing as we speak. Has the Act had any impact?
I think it's had a tremendous impact. Where we've been able to put the money into saving species like California condor or peregrine falcon or even alligators and pelicans and other things that were endangered in those days, we've been very successful. Usually we're not getting species even put on the list until they're almost in an emergency room kind of condition.
Jack, what do you think? Do you think it's worked?
And part of the reason we're not putting species on the list until it's in an emergency room situation is that there are no incentives and no reason for landowners to want to step forward and do things to help. Has the ESA had impact? Absolutely. I mean, you can't look at it and say there have been no successes. But what our organization has always said is that we have never said we want to get rid of the Endangered Species Act. And in fact, what we've been saying is that you can protect species and safeguard the rights of U.S. citizens at the same time. And part of the way you do that is, A, the regulatory certainty that we talked of, but make the science better, as well as, and this is most important, get people involved in the process. Right now, there is nothing that requires people who are utilizing federal land, whether it's for grazing or mining or what have you, to be able to have any impact when federal agencies talk to each other and decide how they want to restrict land use to protect endangered species.
Now, we've only got about a minute left. Given the current disarray of the Congress, is this going to come up this year? And if so, how's it likely to come out? Just 30 seconds from each of you. Brock, what do you think?
Well, I think that given the disarray of this Congress and the polarization of the forces, I'd be surprised if anything major passed. The revision or weakening of the law that Jack's group supported last year was defeated, was not acted upon. We don't think that's going to be brought up, so I'd be surprised. But we're ready to go and ready to talk to anybody to try to make the act better and actually protect species.
Jack, you think there's going to be any change this year?
It will be difficult. You have a small window of 6 to 8 months before the presidential campaign really kicks in, when Republicans and Democrats will officially cease talking to one another. But I think 1180, the bill that Mr. Evans referred to, is a solid piece of legislation, and it's one that actually we have spoken with folks that we can build on and might have some movement on this Congress.
Okay. Well, I assume that there will be great disagreement about that. Our time is up. We appreciate both of you. This was far more civil than the discourse that sometimes I've heard on the issue. We've been discussing the Endangered Species Act, which has been on the books for 25 years. My guests have been Brock Evans, Executive Director of the Endangered Species Coalition, which is comprised of environmental organizations, and Jack Mingus, who is spokesperson for the Endangered Species Reform Coalition, which represents industry ranchers and the development community. We'd like to hear your views on this subject. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Share your thoughts with us or hear us over the Internet. Our address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have special places that touch our soul. For some, it's deep in the wilderness. For some, it's a city street. For author William Tapley, it's an abandoned reservoir in eastern Massachusetts where nothing glamorous lives. In this portrait of place, Tapley reads from his book, A Fly Fishing Life.
The old res was an abandoned reserve water reservoir for the eastern Massachusetts suburb where I grew up. The neighborhood boys had repeatedly vandalized the old brick gatehouse at the outlet, so that water leaked out as fast as it entered. It was shallow and weedy, and it smelled of wet mud and decaying vegetation and dead fish. It wasn't, objectively, much of a fishing hole. It covered only a few surface acres, and nothing glamorous lived there, just stunted sunfish and hornpout and yellow perch, along with an occasional sucker or eel. None of the other boys in my neighborhood fished there. It was too nearby. It lacked mystery. There was nothing worth catching at the old res. But it nestled in a tree-lined bowl a 3-minute walk over the hill behind my house, and it held many fascinations for a boy. Bullfrogs and crawfish lived there, and snapping turtles the size of washtubs. Neon dragonflies and damselflies liked to perch on a rod tip. Herons sometimes high-stepped among the cattails, and most years a pair of mallards raised a family at the old res. On a summer evening, swallows dipped and darted over the water, and when there were bugs on the surface, fish swirled at them, leaving rings that, to my imagination, looked more substantial than any ever made by cracker-sized sunfish. I had no trouble convincing myself that a 4-pound largemouth or two lived there, or maybe a lunk of brown trout. I read the outdoor magazines. I knew that great fish came from unlikely places. I knew that a fisherman's grandest accomplishment was to catch a trophy from a place where no one believed any trophy lived. Naturally, I haunted the old res. Unlike my friends, I had traveled to faraway and mysterious fishing places where eminently worthwhile fish swam. My father was an outdoor writer, and he sometimes took me with him on what he called his research trips. I trolled gray ghosts for landlocked salmon on Sebago and Moosehead, cast deerhair bugs for smallmouth on Winnipesaukee and Champlain, and tried to catch rainbows and browns on dry flies from the Lamoille and the Battenkill. Still, no matter where Dad took me, and no matter what prized fish I caught, I always looked forward to returning to my own private fishing hole over the hill behind my house. I threaded a gob of worms onto a hook and lobbed my bait into the murky waters of the old res. Then I propped my rod on a forked stick, scooched on the bank, and daydreamed while I waited for the inevitable twitch and jerk out there at the end of my line. I believed that the next twitch and jerk could be caused by one of those 4-pound largemouths, and the fact that it never happened didn't shake my faith. When I got tired of fishing, I waded in the shallows and tried to catch crawfish and painted turtles and frogs with my hands. I watched swallows snag mosquitoes and herons spear sunfish. I identified the muskrat and coon tracks on the mud banks. On hot afternoons, I shucked off my clothes and skinny-dipped in the old res, then sprawled in the grass and lay naked under the sun. So I spent the endless days of a boy's summer wandering and exploring and lazing around on the muddy banks of the old res. I learned how to enjoy my own company while staring at the place where my line dipped into the water, and although I couldn't have explained it, I learned about freedom.
That was William Tapley reading from his book, A Fly Fishing Life. It's published by the Lions Press. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Send a copy of this show to Saddam Hussein so he doesn't violate environmental treaties next time he invades Kuwait. Order a tape by calling 1-800-323-9262. It's show number 474. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.